Well, let's dabble with the supernatural, telepathy, UFOs, near-death experiences, human consciousness, singularity. We're going to talk about all of it with Jonathan Zapp, one of his books, Crossing the Event Horizon. And he's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Jonathan Zapp, back with us, author, philosopher, journalist, teacher. He's got all these incredible titles. He has written extensively on psychology, mythology. He's the author, of course, of Zapp Oracle, featured correspondent and editor for Reality Sandwich, which is an online magazine, and of course his book Crossing the Event Horizon. Lots to talk with you about tonight, Jonathan, and welcome back.
Thanks. It's great to be back, George.
So what else, what have you been doing? It's been over a year.
Yeah, well, I've been working away on many topics, and there's a fantasy epic I've been working on since even the early 80s called Parallel Journeys, and that gets me up at 3 o'clock in the morning. I like to write pre-dawn, and I'm really excited about that, and it relates to what we're talking about, which I decided to also explore in fiction form as well as nonfiction.
Good for you. How did you get started into all of this? I mean, these aren't subjects that people just wake up in the morning and say, I love this stuff, I'm going to do it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it happened quite spontaneously and outside of my control. I had some paranormal experiences when I was a child, as many people have, numerous out-of-body experiences and some other things more extreme than that. But one of the first moments where I really first encountered the singularity archetype was watching a black-and-white science fiction movie with my dad, called Village of the Damned. It was a British 1960 film, and in it there were these children who were sort of alien-human hybrids in this English village. They were psychically or telepathically linked to each other. When they did parapsychological things, their eyes would glow. And it's an intriguing film. It was later remade by John Carpenter. That was Christopher Reeve was in the remake of it in the 90s. But whatever it was about this film, and I had seen a million science fiction films like any kid of that era, but this one affected me like a religious vision. I knew there was some powerful, deeper significance that related to my whole destiny and to everything going on in the whole reality. But it was very puzzling as to what that could be. I had similar sort of reactions to a couple other things like Arthur C. Clarke's classic sci-fi novel, Childhood's End. And I thought, wow, this is some of my most personal ideas and fantasies, but here they are in a book written 4 years before I was born. How is that possible? And then in 1978, when I was 20 and set about to do a philosophy honors paper, I decided I was going to try and figure out what's going on with all that kind of stuff. And my mom said, well, you know, she was a psychologist. She said, you should look into this guy, Carl Jung, and his theory of the collective unconscious and the archetypes. So I went up to the school library. There are these impressive black volumes, you know, the Princeton Bullingen edition of Jung's collected works. But I'm sort of thinking skeptically, like, this is a guy who reached manhood in the 19th century. What is he going to tell me, this weird Jewish kid from the Bronx, about my sci-fi obsessions? But I'll give it a try. You know, I look in the index volume and I see, oh, he wrote a book called Flying Saucers, A Modern Myth of Things Seen in the Sky. Well, that was a direct hit because all these stories seem to involve flying saucers. So I go to that one. And I see, wow, you know, he was writing about this right near the end of his life, and he was kind of obsessed with a lot of the things that I was. And then at the end of the book, there's like an epilogue, and then after the epilogue, there is an afterword. It was like he couldn't let go of the subject, and then after the afterword, there's a supplement. Well, in the supplement consisted of Jung's analysis of a British sci-fi novel called The Midwich Cuckoos, by John Wyndham. Well, that was the novel that the movie Village of the Damned was based on. So in my first encounter with Jung was incredibly synchronistic, and of course he's the inventor of the term synchronicity and the concept, and this was almost like Jung, like a wizard bearing a torch, stepping out of the bookcase and saying, like, hey, I was looking at that one too, and here's what I thought. And, you know, I was basically able to see much more of the phenomenon because Jung wrote about it near the end of his life, and he didn't get to see how the UFO phenomenon developed, and he had a near-death experience himself in 1948, but he didn't live to see the era of near-death experience research and so forth. So I was sort of able to pick up where he left off and to use the tools of Jungian psychology to discover what I call the singularity archetype in 1978. And it has amazing implications for the individual lifespan and for the lifespan of the whole species.
When you talk about synchronicity, Jonathan, tell me your definition of that.
Well, you know, I stick with Jung's definition of, as the eight causal connecting principle. It's like when two things line up. You know, one is in your psyche. Something has a meaning. But then something very related to it happens in the outside physical world, but you can't establish a cause and effect way that those two things came together. It's just sort of this uncanny parallelism. But there is some recent new thinking about synchronicity in the world of paranormal research, because a lot of synchronicities, it's now believed, and there's a good case for it, are actually cases of short-term clairvoyance. Because some of the best, most replicated parapsychological experiments we've been able to do show that a very substantial number of people will have, and they'll show this through biometric sensors, will have a precognitive response a few seconds before an upsetting image is flashed on a computer screen. And so since this is so well demonstrated, some synchronicities could actually be you're getting things to line up in the outside world because you sense something is coming. Like somebody talks about a certain phrase and then they find that a few seconds later they come upon that phrase engraved on the sidewalk. They may have had a precognitive sense that was coming and sort of helped line up the synchronicity, and therefore it isn't really a synchronicity because it's causal, because you had some sort of information and sort of made it happen. And so it's a complicated concept in some ways, but that's my basic view on it.
Do you think synchronicity has anything to do with chance or luck?
Well, it would be considered the opposite of chance or luck, because it would be chance or luck would be coincidence, and synchronicity is sort of a meaningful coincidence. You know, if you had to use the word coincidence, it's where things are lining up in a way that is not random. And, you know, according to some information scientists, the idea that anything even could be random may be one of the greatest wrong turnings that science ever took. The idea of randomness implies that the system can't have a memory. You know, if you toss a coin, but somehow the coin knows whether it's heads or tails last time, that would make it a poor random generator. And so it's believed that there is a memory in the whole system of the universe, and therefore, just like we discovered that even in black holes, information is conserved, and therefore there may not be any such thing as randomness.
How did this ability get in the universe, this ability for people to tap into it, to make it work? I mean, who put it there?
Well, we really don't know. I mean, because for one thing, it's one of those billion-dollar questions, because there's so many different possible answers, and I don't know if anybody can satisfactorily say which one it might be. But I guess since synchronicity itself seems to be a spontaneous interaction between us and the material world, which is not as material as we thought it was at one time, that it's sort of, if the whole universe is psyche, if everything is, you know, there was the ancient Greek scientists, there were the atomists, they tried to find out what that indivisible particle was, they called it an atom, and at one point we thought atoms were like billiard balls, and so there's been this search in philosophy and science to find the monad, what is the indivisible thing that makes up the whole reality? And basically where science is at right now is that it's probably something pretty close to information, like maybe Einstein thought it was energy, but now it's like information. And some physicists, like Fred Allen Wolf and Amit Goswami, say, you know, well, if you think of the monad as consciousness, then all the paradoxes of quantum mechanics vanish. And things like synchronicity don't seem so remarkable anymore, because basically if we're in one field of consciousness, then why wouldn't things line up? Just like when we're in a dream, we're not surprised that what happens in the dream reflects who we are inwardly. And so if we're in a collective dream, a collective field of consciousness, that effect should also pertain. So we're discovering that, you know, the physics of the dream time and the physics of the waking time are not as different as, you know, our patriarchal education might have led us to believe. And so when you have a synchronicity, it's like what in a dream would be normal, because in most dreams, everything relates to inner psychic content. And with the synchronicity, it's just seems like a rare moment in the physical world where the same principle applies.
You have talked about singularity as well.
Mm-hmm.
How does that tie into this?
Well, and I should make a distinction here, because there's a lot, you know, I started writing about the singularity archetype in 1978, and since then, there are a lot of people like Ray Kurzweil and certain technological futurists who talk about the singularity with somewhat of a different spin. Like they tend to be materialists, and so they expect it to emerge from computer hardware and things like that. And actually, technology, the technological innovations and singularities are definitely part of what I talk about too. They are shifting consciousness, and they are a key player. But what I'm particularly writing about is the singularity archetype. And archetypes are these great primordial forms in the collective unconscious. We have a collective psyche that's been demonstrated many times. Rupert Sheldrake has done all kinds of experiments and shown, given evidence to show that there is a kind of common human mind at a certain level, and that's why we have certain motifs and archetypes that occur in any period, in any place, and there are sort of like organs or living agencies within that collective mind that we call archetypes. And to give it, last time I think I could use the hero as an example, mm-hmm. But this time I'll talk about the Pro Eternus for a moment, the eternal youth, which is, you know, a lot of people, because archetypes both inspire and possess. So somebody who has the Pro Eternus archetype very strongly in them will be very adventurous and youthful and always looking for new things. A person who seems inspired by the Pro Eternus archetype was Michael Jackson, who identified with Peter Pan. But at the same time, archetypes also, every archetype has a dark side, and so they can possess. So, you know, Michael Jackson had excess plastic surgery and maybe inappropriate sleepovers and so forth. And so we see that, you know, these archetypes form who we are, and almost everybody is dominated by at least one or more archetypes. So the singularity archetype, you could also think of as sort of a portal of transformation. It is stands at the event horizon, two great event horizons that parallel. One is the great event horizon for the individual lifespan of death, and the other is eschaton, the kind of end of the species, because the species, you know, has a lifespan as well.
Do you think we're headed that way?
Well, it's inevitable that every species is heading toward that event horizon, just like every person is heading toward death. The average lifespan of a mammalian species is a million years. And so, you know, it's not expected for a species to last forever. But
they're always replaced, aren't they?
Yeah, and we may actually be, when we hit that event horizon, we may be replaced by a new form. There may be a quantum evolutionary shift where we become something very different. And just like the small part recapitulates the whole in a fractal or a hologram, the life cycle of the individual is the same. So we don't have to wait for the species to end or wait for some dramatic end times. We're guaranteed that because we are here for a limited time only. And crossing the event horizon of death is we become something else. And people have crossed that event horizon and come back. And those are our near-death experiencers. And everything that the singularity archetype predicts about the future, because it's sort of a portal that sends back energy and information, almost like a black hole even does that, that tells us something about the nature of our future metamorphosis, everything that it says about the future metamorphosis of the species actually happens to people when they have near-death experiences, like a telepathic network and a more powerful form of vision and a transformation of the body and a transformation of the ego. All these things actually happen during NDEs.
Telepathy. and its incredible ability to do some incredible things. That's all tied into all of this as well. Why do some people have the ability, Jonathan, to do it, and other people don't?
Well, one way of thinking about it is to see why not having telepathy served an evolutionary purpose. I think actually a telepathic network between members of the same species is actually more like the norm in nature. I mean, if you look at social insects, if you look at schools of fish swimming perfectly in tune with each other, or flocks of birds doing that, I think that's the norm. But it served a great purpose to create the ego, which sort of helps to encapsulate the individual psyche and cut it off from group telepathy. And we have less group telepathy in the modern world than, say, in tribal cultures. What we get by not having telepathy is the greatest engine of novelty and change ever discovered, and that's individuality. We're far more individual than all these other species that have more group telepathy. And so what the singularity archetype predicts is a return to this telepathic ability that we never entirely lost, but has been suppressed by the ego and to help create individuality. When it reemerges, individuality will not be lost. It will be conserved. And also the telepathy, because conventionally we think of telepathy as I hear your thoughts, which is really hardly better than speaking them aloud or calling somebody on the phone. But in the more powerful versions of telepathy, like we see in mutual dreaming and in certain other strange circumstances, like when people are part of an ayahuasca ritual, it's often a visual telepathy or a full mode telepathy. So if you think of mutual dreaming, it can involve talk, it involves sight, settings, everything. It's basically a virtual reality would be a technological form of it in a way. And virtual reality may be one of the things that will help trigger the reemergence of this kind of profound telepathic communication between people.
Are you amazed, though, that it works, that it actually really works?
I am, but you know, the thing is that William James, who was a great pioneering American psychologist from Harvard around the turn of the century, said something that's always stayed with me. He said, all that's necessary to disprove the notion that all crows are black is one white crow.
That's right.
If we have one case of telepathy, one mother who, remote from sensory information, knows that her kid is in trouble at a distance, you know, that basically proves that telepathy is just part of the human performance envelope, and presently, and it may emerge only episodically, but it's definitely there. And so, you know, one of the cases where this telepathy works in the most profound way is in mutual dreaming. Now, this was, you know, exaggerated in a great cinematic way in the movie Inception, but as somebody who's done dream interpretation for 30 years, people do report to me, I've had one personal experience, mutual dreams, which are more likely when people are sleeping in the same room, but they can happen at a distance too. So now if you think about this, you know, right now we're making these little mouth noises, as my late colleague Terrence McKenna called it, and it's a somewhat primitive form of communication, but if I could, instead of telling you what I'm seeing, be like, George, come into my dream and see it in every dimension. I mean, that's much more profound. It's just like movies are considered the queen of the arts because they can involve writing, song, dance, painting, you know, whatever you can put it in a movie. Well, in a mutual dream, you can talk, but you can have all this other stuff. You can reveal your psychological content visually and so as well. And so that's much more profound. And so that's more like the type of telepathic network that seems to be envisioned for the future and that also happens to people when they have near-death experiences.
All right, we're going to talk more about this with you, Jonathan, when we roll right back on Coast to Coast AM. Cosmic Disclosure, it's with David Wilcock and Corey Good, and you can watch it by going to our website, beyondbelief.com. Take a look at that, and of course, while you're there, look at our program, beyondbelief.com as well. Number of shows, you can watch as many as you want at beyondbelief.com. And welcome back, Jonathan Zapp with us. Jonathan, where would you put remote viewing into all of this?
Well, remote viewing, one of the things that it shows us is that we are not really altogether in our bodies. And that's some of the things that some of your guests like Russell Targ have pointed out, because in the early days of parapsychology, like early Soviet parapsychologists called telepathy mental radio. So they thought of it in a causal way, that it must be like a radio, it must be a signal that goes out. But what Russell Targ and some others have shown is that it doesn't diminish, remote viewing doesn't diminish through distance and time or space. You can put somebody in a Faraday cage that blocks all electromagnetic radiation, and that doesn't diminish the effect. And so really, what the conclusion that he's come to, and some others, is that nothing, you're not going out to look at something. You're part of the same sort of oneness that it is, and so you can sort of locate it from within. And so it really is showing us our potential to explode the limited kind of vision, limited kind of senses that we have when we're more closely bound to our physical bodies.
So back with telepathy, there's a tie-in, of course, with everything. It's all intertwined. It's like the Matrix. I call it the wireless internet out there. Mm-hmm. Jonathan, what would you call it?
Well, I would call it the collective psyche, and I think, I agree with you that all of this is interrelated, and I think that the nexus, the real interrelation point that you can relate ufology, telepathy, near-death experience, and so many of the different things on your show is the singularity archetype. It's a portal of transformation that produces profound effects when people encounter it, even as a vision, but also when they step through it during perhaps an hallucinogenic experience, a near-death experience, an out-of-body experience, and often during dreams, people have step up to the threshold of the singularity archetype, and it brings with it telepathic effects. It's sort of a rupture of plane experience where every of the normal variables, your perception of them at least changes drastically. And so I think it sort of is the underlying factor governing the whole matrix that we're experiencing.
Human consciousness, of course, the ability to do, I think, some incredible things. How much of it do you think is tied to the physical brain as opposed to this matrix we've been talking about?
Well, it's a great question, and we live in an era where the ruling creed is one of materialism, and that includes neurological materialism. So, if you in the colleges and universities and in the halls of science, most people assume that if consciousness exists, because in science and even in philosophy, many don't believe that it does, which I think is absurd, of course, but it's assumed that it's just sort of an epiphenomenon. It's a secondary effect of biochemical process in the brain. And that's why, we think we can solve people's spiritual problems by giving them pills and often with disastrous results. Many findings from parapsychology, but especially from near-death experience, I believe incontrovertibly disprove the position of neurological materialism. And neurological materialism is half right in that the condition of your brain has profound effects on what you experience while you're in this body and you are, using it as a transceiver. But the fact that people like Pam Reynolds, if you're familiar with the Pam Reynolds case, the fact that people can have incredible vision with their eyes taped shut, that they can comprehend all kinds of things far better than they could when they were in their body, when their heart is completely stopped, when their brain should not be functioning at all and should not be able to produce complex experiences, unlike, the debunkers who haven't done their homework and think it could be caused by an oxygen-starved brain or something like that, which is even neurologically absurd. You can't form these complex memories when your brain is oxygen-starved. And so the brain is a huge player, just like our whole body is in our experience when we are tied to it, but we are capable of breaking those ties, and we discovered that our consciousness is non-local, and that's why remote viewing works, and that's why many of our experiences show that we are non-local beings.
You were talking earlier before the break about entering dreamlike states. I'm convinced that there are people who have that ability, that they can enter somebody else's dream or mindset and change things and make things happen?
Well, it's a possibility that definitely definitely haunts our imagination, if nothing else. And I think it no doubt at some point that has happened in real life. People often conventionally assume that they're alone in their dreams. What more often invades dreams, and there are all kinds of sort of entity attacks that happen in dreams, may not be people, but maybe other organisms that live on an energetic plane that's closer to the dream time. And they may be departed souls, they may be all kinds of different things, but people do have entities enter their dream space and cause them to see fearful, horrifying images. This is reported in all cultures, by the way, so whenever we have something that's reported in every culture, you know, there's something wrong with a society that doesn't pay attention to that testimony, and fundamentalist materialism, the reigning creed of scientism, doesn't. But, you know, every culture, the Christians called them incubi and succubi, these parasitic beings that would attack people in their sleep, they're recognized by every culture, and they can manipulate people to create fear, which seems to produce an energy that they can feed off of, where they can't feed off of certain other energies, such as, you know, higher consciousness, love, calmness, and so forth. And that's why people who, you know, will say a prayer, or they will, you know, say the name of their something from their religion that gives them spiritual confidence and will cause such entities to retreat for that reason. It's something that seems very subjective and very woo-woo to some people. But, you know, if you think about it, we're capable of missing a whole dimension of life. Every culture did that when it came to the microbiological plane. It wasn't until a Dutch shopkeeper in the 1700s, A.V. Leeuwenhoek, you know, created the first primitive microscope that we discovered that, oh my God, there's this vast cryptozoology of species, and not only are they out there all around us, actually, we are them. They are us. Our body is a network of 60 trillion of these cells. I mean, if that's so staggering, why is it staggering to think that there's another dimension of life reported by every culture that exists on a more energetic plane? And in that, just like we discovered in the microbiological world, same as in the macrobiological world, we discovered that there would be symbiotic organisms, that there'd be predatory ones, and that there'd be parasitic ones. And so, just as in alchemy, they say, as above, so below. Not surprisingly, in the realm of energetic organisms, given different names by different cultures, we also find symbionts, predators, and parasites.
And parasites, what do they do, these parasites?
Well, they drain energy, and you know, parasites are so basic to biology that according to National Geographic, parasites outnumber all other types of organisms on this planet 4 or 5 to 1. Most organisms have parasites, and many parasites themselves have parasites, like malaria is a microbiological parasite that lives inside of mosquitoes. And there are even some British biologists who've come up with what they call the Red Queen hypothesis that says that sexual differentiation was an evolutionary response to parasites, that the only way, because parasites are so well adopted, that the only way hosts could stay ahead of them was through the greater genetic novelty of sexual reproduction. So that's how deeply parasites are embedded in life. And just like microbiological parasites or macrobiological parasites want to feed off the richest energy they can, like your blood or whatever, energetic parasites want to feed off of your emotions, your sexual chi, the stuff that makes us human and that makes us the most powerful organisms on the planet. That's a very juicy stuff, apparently, in that energetic sphere. And, you know, there are always things out there that want to feed on your energy.
We're with Jonathan Zapp. Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines. And in addition to your questions, would love your stories on running into any psychic vampires or any telepathic experience that you might have had, things that might have saved your life or some of the people that you care about, because it does work. What about people who just need to learn how to read those abilities, Jonathan? They just don't seem to pick up on it until after the fact. It's too late.
Well, I mean, that's true in the conventional world too. Like, there's a renowned security expert, Gavin DeBecker, wrote a best-selling book called The Gift of Fear. And what his research, he does security for like movie stars and heads of state and so forth as a security company. And what his research showed is that most people who are subject to violence had warning intuitions, and there were all kinds of pre-incident indicators that they overrode. So the reason why people don't pick up on some of these more psychic things are the same reason why they may not pick up that, you know, somebody has a creepy aspect and shouldn't, they shouldn't get on an elevator with them, or, you know, or even when there are conventional sensory clues available. People are, we're sort of culturally trained to live out of our mind and ego, and intuition is suppressed. People have the intuition, but they don't take it seriously. They don't sort of read it. It's sort of just in the background of their minds. And if people were able to learn to bring the intuition forward, there's some ideas about how to do that on my website and a document called A Guide to the Perplexed Interdimensional Traveler. Then they will be more tuned in to all sorts of things, conventional and paranormal as well.
You have looked at why people predict the end of the world, and of course, it hasn't happened yet. Most civilizations have always thought that they were in end times. So what makes this any different?
Well, so remember I talked about like with the For Eternus with Michael Jackson,
Yeah.
every archetype has a light and a dark side. So the dark side of the singularity archetype is apocalypticism, which has been a popular brand since even before Zoroastrianism. You know, there was an Assyrian clay tablet from like 1600 BC that said, you know, we are surely in the end times. Things are speedily coming to an end. And so basically, there are a couple of things going on. One is that when the ego perceives the singularity archetype, just like when the ego perceives death, it sees the dark side of it. It sees it as annihilation. Whether that's annihilation of the species or annihilation of the individual consciousness. When that higher self sees it sees it as a portal of metamorphosis. So when the singularity archetype pathologizes, it turns into apocalypticism. And another aspect of apocalypticism is that because people are afraid of their guaranteed event horizon of death, apocalypticism is kind of a way to displace the fear of death onto this collective event. Because from the ego point of view, one of the things that's most disturbing about death is the idea that, like, you know, other people will keep going on, they can use my stuff, they can talk about me, I'll be gone. But if everybody's going to check out at once, and if there's some kind of rapture and some kind of like damnation for the kind of people you don't like, it's sort of an all-satisfying scenario for the ego to take its fear of death and project it outward, because we're always confused about what's inside and what's outside. So somebody gets this feeling, because we could all have that feeling at any time of like our mortality and the imminence of, you know, death and so forth, and they feel like this could all end. The world is coming to an end. There was a woman named Elizabeth Steen out in the Bay Area in the 60s who began predicting, you know, this apocalyptic earthquake that would destroy California. And you know, she was sincere enough about it that she moved her family, I think, somewhere in the Northwest. And this was such a big thing that it was reported. There were several articles on the New York Times. Other psychics in copycat fashion also picked up this date in 1969. And on that date, there was no earthquake. But a few days before, this relatively young woman in her 30s, Elizabeth Steen, died of some rare
Oh,
complication to a
jeez.
disease, usually not fatal. So
Huh.
people, and then this is why apocalyptic predictions are almost always conveniently scheduled to occur before the expected lifespan of the person who's obsessed with it would run out. And that's why people, you know, always love the next one up, like whether it was 2012 or whatever. And, you know, I'll make a prediction for you right now, because I think prophecy is notoriously unreliable. But if Coast to Coast is still going in the 2040s, you're going to have people come on who've written books called The Newton Code. Because Newton predicted, Sir Isaac Newton, you know, he spent a lot of his life in occult research, and he came up through looking at the Book of Revelation and so forth, the date 2050. But you don't hear much talk about it now, even though he's considered the father of modern science and so forth, because 2050 isn't a sexy date. It's too far out. Nobody wants to wait to 2050. If you're an older person who might really get into apocalypticism, you kind of know that you probably won't live that long. So nobody, it's not appealing. And so that's why, you know, that motivates people to find a date that's this close up. But another case of where apocalypticism, you know, can be even seen even more clearly as the singularity archetype pathologizing is the Heaven's Gate suicide cult, where in 1997, 39 people all decided that there was a mother ship on the other side of the Hale-Bopp comet and that they were going to commit suicide and go out there, and they called themselves a form beyond human. They thought that they were going to cross the event horizon. And this, of course, is connected to the history of the Coast to Coast show, because if you remember, Coast to Coast was totally inappropriately, you know, in the early news reports about Heaven's Gate, you know, blamed for this.
Sure.
Because somebody reported on that or something. It was ridiculous. But if you look, the Heaven's Gate website is even still up, and every notion they had was about telepathy. It was about something related to the singularity archetype. So that's like the singularity archetype going wrong, just like for Michael Jackson, the Pre-Eternus archetype started to go wrong in some ways for him. And so apocalypticism is a big part of the dark side of this archetype.
So many things have been happening in this universe, Jonathan. How do people who really want to get into this and train themselves to have telepathy, to have these abilities, to you know, better their luck, how do they get into this?
Well, there are many, many different ways in. I mean, I would start with just remembering your dreams, because if you consider the cost and the danger that people go through to take various hallucinogens and so forth, but every night you're having something that is an amazing alternate reality experience, often with huge telepathic effects, because when you're in your dream body, you're not bound by the same. You're not as bound by your brain, even though we can show electrical activity in the brain that's different when you're dreaming. And that's why time kind of surrealizes in dreams. You can be back in places that haven't existed. You can be in different ages and different bodies. You're not bound by gravity. And the dream body is closer to our non-local body. And so just by getting in touch with your dreams, you can become more intuitive. And of course, there's many, many other ways to enhance these abilities and to get tuned in. And I think some of the ways are about to be delivered to the consumer culture. And because technology will play a huge role as a catalyst. And Oculus Rift, I predict, and other such high-quality virtual reality consumer-grade technologies are going to profoundly change things, because you're going to have something that's very much like the Dreamtime, and that we can actually do right now with off-the-shelf hardware. So if you think about, you know, the experience that people have, you know, with networked video games, you know, like World of Warcraft, or in one that eliminates the first-person shooter thing and where people just hang out, Second Life. I haven't been on there in a while, and their graphics may not be good enough, but it sort of creates a virtual world where you can just sort of walk around and meet people.
The planet's going to become a virtual planet, there's no doubt. Jonathan, we're going to come back and take calls, and I'd like you to also share stories with us. Maybe you've used telepathy, or you've been next to a psychic vampire.